Stalin was in high spirits after the Ribbentrop Pact, but he remained dangerously paranoid, especially to the wives of his friends. In November 1939, Stalin attended the birthday party of Kulik, the bungling deputy defense commissar who had commanded the Polish invasion. His long-legged, green-eyed wife, Kira, approached Stalin, chatting to him like an old friend. The most unlikely member of Stalin's circle, she was trebly tainted, for she was an aristocrat with links to Tsarist intelligence and the ex-wife of an arrested Jewish merchant. Like Bronka, Kira shone at Kremlin parties. Waiting until she was alone by the piano with Stalin, she asked him to free her brother, a former Tsarist officer, from the camps. Stalin listened affably, then put on the gramophone, playing his favorites. Everyone danced except him. Kira's approach, presuming on her familiarity and prettiness, had set a man-trap in his suspicious mind. Days later, Kulik ordered the artillery barrage that commenced the Soviet invasion of Finland, which, like the Baltic states, had been part of the Russian Empire until 1918, and which now threatened Leningrad. On the 12th of October, a Finnish delegation met Stalin and Molotov in the Kremlin to hear the Soviet demands for the cession of a naval base at Hango. The Finns refused, much to Stalin's surprise. "This cannot continue for long without the danger of accidents," he said, and sent Finland his ultimatum. On the 30th of November, five Soviet armies attacked along the 800-mile border. Their assaults were foiled by the ingenious Finns, who, dressed like ghosts in white, slaughtered the Russians. The forests were decorated with frozen pyramids of Soviet corpses. The Finns used 70,000 empty bottles filled with gasoline against the Russian tanks, the first Molotov cocktails, one part of his cult of personality that the vain Premier surely did not appreciate. Stalin approached the Winter War amateurishly, like a local exercise, ignoring the Chief of Staff Shaposhnikov's professional plan. Stalin and Zhdanov were so confident they created a crude puppet government of Finnish communists. After the 9th of December, the 9th Army was decimated around the destroyed village of Suomussalmi. Stalin's military amateurs reacted with spasms of executions and recriminations. "I regard a radical purge as essential," Voroshilov warned the 44th Division. On the 26th, Stalin finally appointed Timoshenko to command the Northwestern Front and restore order to his frayed forces who were now dying of hunger. Stalin sensed the army was concealing the scale of the disaster. Trusting only Mekhlis, he wrote, "The annihilation of the 44th Division. Tell me, first, is this true? Second, where is the division's military council and chief of staff? How do they explain their shameful conduct? Why did they desert their division? Third, why does the military council of the 9th Army not inform us? We expect an answer. Stalin." Mekhlis arrived in Suomussalmi to find chaotic scenes which he made worse. He confirmed the losses and shot the whole command. Unlike many of Stalin's commissars, Mekhlis was personally courageous, if not suicidally reckless. He took command of fleeing companies and led them at the enemy. Mekhlis and Kulik did not conceal the mess. "We lack bread in the army," Mekhlis reported. Kulik agreed. "Rigidity and bureaucracy are everywhere." Stalin was saddened by these disasters. The pressure made him ill, with his usual streptococcus and staphylococcus, a temperature and an agonizing sore throat. His health improved as Timoshenko probed Finnish defenses, launching a great offensive on the 11th. Soviet superiority finally took its toll on the plucky Finns, who sued for peace. On the 12th of March, Zhdanov signed a treaty in which Finland ceded 22,000 square miles to insulate Leningrad. Finland lost around 48,000 soldiers, Stalin over 125,000. Stalin's anger boiled over. He started shouting at Voroshilov, who gave as good as he got, shrieking at Stalin, "You have yourself to blame for all of this. You're the one who annihilated the old guard of our army. You had our best generals killed." Stalin rebuffed him, at which Voroshilov picked up a platter of roast suckling pig and smashed it on the table. Khrushchev admitted, "It was the only time in my life I witnessed such an outburst. Voroshilov alone could have got away with it." Stalin raised military morale, restoring the rank of general and the single command by soldiers, whose tasks had been made incomparably harder by sharing control with interfering commissars. He freed 11,178 purged officers who officially returned from a long and dangerous mission. Stalin asked one of them, perhaps noticing his lack of fingernails, "Were you tortured in prison?" "Yes, Comrade Stalin." "There's too many yes-men in this country," sighed Stalin, "but some did not come back." "Where's your Serditch?" Stalin asked Budioni about a mutual friend. "Executed." "Pity. I wanted to make him ambassador to Yugoslavia." Stalin turned to his own tribe, who remained obsessed with cavalry and oblivious to modern warfare. Budioni and Kulik believed tanks could never replace horses. Stalin and Voroshilov had abolished special tank corps. Fortunately, Timoshenko, the new defense commissar, now persuaded the Vujt to reverse his folly. "They were competent people," wrote Mikoyan, "but Stalin was increasingly distrustful of people, so trust was more important than anything." Stalin wavered, meandered, and reversed his own decisions. It is remarkable any correct decisions were made at all. In May, Stalin ordered the kidnapping of Kulik's wife, Kira. 2 days later, Stalin promoted her husband to marshal, along with Timoshenko and Shaposhnikov, in what can only be called a stroke of ironical sadism. Kulik's delight at his promotion was tempered by worry about his wife. He called Beria, who invited him to his office. While Kulik sipped tea, Beria called Stalin. "Marshal Kulik's sitting in front of me." No, he doesn't know any details. She left, and that's all." "Certainly, Comrade Stalin, we'll do everything possible to find her." They both knew that Kira, the mother of an 8-year-old daughter, was in the cells beneath Beria's office. A month later, she was moved to Beria's special prison and murdered. The public search for Kira Kulik continued for 12 years, but the marshal himself had long since realized that her dubious connections had destroyed her. He soon married again. Meanwhile, Stalin and his magnates debated the fate of the Polish officers, arrested or captured in September 1939, and held in 3 camps, one of which was close to Katyn Forest. When Stalin was undecided about an issue, there was surprisingly frank discussion. Kulik, commander of the Polish front, proposed freeing all the Poles. Voroshilov agreed, but Mechlis was adamant there were enemies among them. Stalin stopped the release, but Kulik persisted. Stalin compromised. The Poles were released, except for about 26,000 officers, landowners, and policemen. Their massacre was a chunk of black work for the NKVD, who were accustomed to the vujka of a few victims at a time. But there was a man for the task. V.M. Blokhin and 2 other Chekists outfitted a hut with padded, soundproofed walls and decided on a Stakhanovite quota of 250 shootings a night. He brought a butcher's leather apron and cap, which he put on when he began one of the most prolific acts of mass murder by one individual, killing 7,000 in precisely 28 nights, using a German Walther pistol to prevent future exposure. That June, the Führer unleashed his blitzkrieg against the Low Countries and France. Stalin still counted on France and Britain holding up Hitler in the West. On the 17th of June 1940, France sued for peace, a shock that should have made Stalin reassess his alliance with Hitler, though it was now the only game in town. A rattled Stalin cursed the Allies. "Couldn't they put up any resistance at all?" he asked Khrushchev. "Now Hitler's going to beat our brains in." Stalin rushed to consume the Baltic states and Bessarabia, part of Romania. As troops moved across the borders, Soviet bombers flew Stalin's proconsuls to their fiefdoms, Dekanozov to Lithuania, Deputy Premier, the former Procurator Vyshinsky to Latvia, and Zhdanov to Estonia. 170,000 Latvians, Estonians, and Lithuanians were murdered or deported. "Comrade Beria," said Stalin, "will take care of the accommodation of our Baltic guests." The NKVD put icing on Stalin's cake on the 20th of August, when Beria's agent, Ramon Mercader, shattered Trotsky's skull with an ice pick. His death closed the chapter of the Great Terror. Vengeance was Stalin's.